This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we examine calls for a public and full investigation into police actions at the January 6th Capitol riot.
The fact is that the fascists in this country mobilized, they're still mobilizing, and they're being let go with hardly a slap on the wrist.
New evidence has been disclosed that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover was in on the police murder of Black Panther Fred Hampton.
He actually authorized a bonus to people who facilitated the assassination of a civil rights leader. Is this stuff still going on?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Many are saying that the police were caught off guard when rioters stormed the nation's capital on January 6, leaving four people dead. It was the most significant breach of Congress in more than 200 years, and pro-Trump rioters promised that it won't be the last. In their violent and lawless efforts to upend what they called a fraudulent election, the rioters faced minimal police resistance. Far-right mobs smashed windows and doors, stormed the Capitol behind a traitorous, terrorist Confederate flag, and burst into the Senate chamber. Unlike Black Lives Matter protesters and legions of peaceful demonstrators before them, police have consistently used potentially lethal weapons to disperse social justice mass demonstrations. But how could the Capitol be unprepared? Word on social media and in the news was that fascists planned to converge in throngs with guns prior to the changing of presidential administrations. One group that specializes in protest defense, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, is partnering with the newly formed Center for Protest Law and Litigation to demand a fully public investigation into law enforcement's handling of the riot on the Capitol building on a day that shocked the nation and the world. Joining us from D.C. is attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard from the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Mara, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Mara, you assert that the January 6th riot in D.C. could only have happened because law enforcement allowed it to happen. Please explain.
Well, as actually anyone who has ever protested at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. knows, and I'm talking about protests, not riots and violent insurrections, just peaceful protests. The Capitol Police have all the material at their disposal, and they don't hesitate to use it against peaceful protesters. We have seen them come out in full force, riot gear against nonviolent peaceful protesters and permitted demonstrations. We have seen them brutally arrest peaceful protesters who are speaking out inside the Capitol. And moreover, over the 20 years of litigation that we have carried out in Washington, D.C., we have seen the documents that are routinely and always created among all the different agencies in Washington, D.C. in advance of any major event that is occurring. So in Washington, we have all these different law enforcement jurisdictions that operate here. And anytime any major activity is occurring, there is, as a matter of sophisticated process, all this interagency planning, intelligence, and mutual aid efforts that go into operation. Now, here you had a violent white supremacist mob that was publicly bragging about what they intended to do in advance. They were publicly posting and bragging about their intention to smuggle weapons into the district to go after Congress and the Capitol. It is not possible that the law enforcement agencies, including the Capitol Police, could have been caught, quote unquote, off guard or just been unprepared. This could only happen if there was a decision made to allow this to happen.
That's a pretty heavy thought. You're working with the Center for Protest Law and Litigation. Tell us about what that is.
The Center for Protest Law and Litigation is a new project of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. We are very excited about this initiative. It is bringing together much of the focus of our work for many years and creating a directed project with to build out the necessary resources to defend and protect First Amendment rights across the United States, to provide support to progressive frontline activists, to the attorneys that defend them, and to really focus and enshrine these absolute needs that we must have in a democracy to defend free speech rights at a time when we can see this extraordinary attack on the capacity of the people of the United States to speak out in peaceful protest, which I note is in complete contrast to the capacity of right-wing white supremacist mobs to violently attack the Capitol and in large part appear to be getting a free pass.
Mara, I want to follow up on your comment about how police have treated peaceful protesters. Just paint the picture, humor us, and describe what you think it would have looked like if hundreds or thousands of Black Lives Matter and other social justice activists converged, traveled all from all parts of the country and converged in front of the Capitol on January 6th. What would that scene have looked like?
Well, quite frankly, I think we all know that if there had been a call for a mass Black-led march on the Capitol, even one that said that it was nonviolent, but a mass march on the Capitol with people saying they intended to come up the steps and they wanted to come inside, putting aside even the issue of weapons, that march on the Capitol, if it had been Black-led, I think would have looked like a massacre. And that's a reality that we know and that we see across the United States when over and over again, and in Washington, D.C., peaceful racial justice protesters, peaceful, have been subject to mass false arrest, to chemical weapons, to being soaked in chemical weapons, to the use of projectile weapons, to being maimed, to being kettled, to being beaten. And yet here you have a planned, organized, right-wing, white supremacist riot, and the police treated it with kid gloves at the onset. And while there certainly were line police who were struggling at a point against this mob, you could also see that there were other police throughout the Capitol who were allowing in different locations this mob access and to enter. And it's not just the line police. We can see that at going up the chain of command to the very high level officials, to the sergeants at arms, they made decisions. They made decisions that allowed this mob to violently attack the Capitol.
Mara, let's contrast that to the event in 2007 when the Capitol Police arrested 200 anti-war activists in a situation which was led by veterans, and they sought to peaceably deliver a letter to the door of Congress. What led up to these arrests?
Well, that demonstration where we provided legal support to the demonstrators and the organizers, both in advance of the demonstration and afterwards when they were illegally arrested, and I represented people at trial in this matter, that's a very significant contrast. I mean, here you had, it was a peaceful, organized, planned demonstration. It had permits. And the veterans, led by anti-war veterans, veterans from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, wanted to march to the Capitol and they wanted to deliver the letter. They didn't even want to go inside and didn't try to go inside. They simply were going to the areas that are already accessible to the public. The Capitol Police came out in huge numbers, in full riot gear, in, you know, looking like robocops. They put up a police line way out in front of the Capitol. So they were actually stopping people from accessing areas that are normally available to public access. And when the veterans wanted to move forward and wanted to deliver a letter, an anti-war letter, they were arrested. Hundreds were arrested. And there was no hesitation by the Capitol Police to have this massive display of force to arrest these veterans and to keep them from actually accessing space that had hours earlier been available to tourists. Now, you can't look at that and say that somehow the Capitol Police were caught off guard with this violent attack on the Capitol from, you know, Trump's right-wing mob, and knowing the material, the personnel, and the capacity that they have, again, it shows that there was a decision made to allow this to happen.
Mara, going back to the interagency documents that you obtained, let's once again picture what it might have looked like if police properly planned for the events of January 6th, given that it was well known the mob was openly planning violence and they were bragging that they were smuggling guns to D.C. What should it have looked like?
Normally what we see is an advance of activities in D.C. And I note again, I'm talking about an advance of peaceful, lawful, permitted assemblies in Washington, D.C., let alone, you know, a planning, violent, insurrectionist, seditious mob. We're just talking about in the documents that we see with peaceful events. All of the agencies in D.C., they circulate materials amongst each other. There are both the sort of the informal communications on email chains, but there are formal interagency planning documents where they are planning in advance of any event. They are providing their quote-unquote intelligence about what they believe is going to happen, having personnel available, putting out personnel from different agencies. They have mutual aid agreements, so they have the capacity to have other agencies at the ready or to come in advance. And they have real-time capacities. The district operates joint operation command centers. They have both fixed centers, and they have special operation command centers, where within those entities, all of the law enforcement agencies have sort of what's called a desk, a location where they are all communicating with each other in real time. They are looking at multiple screens that are showing everything that's happening, you know, through the CCTV cameras throughout the district. They have real-time feeds coming in from the ground. They can have real-time feeds coming in from helicopters as well as stationary cameras. They set up cameras specific to events. They have people all over the ground. I mean, this is not, a situation where it's just some locality that can be caught off guard. This is the capital of the United States. They have a very, very sophisticated structure in place. That's what exists behind the scenes. So every time that we're seeing law enforcement saying, oh, they were caught off guard or they didn't have the resources, that is completely, completely false.
We're speaking with Mara Verheyden-Hilliard of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. And she's working through the Center for Protest Law and Litigation. Mara, why do we need a full and public investigation into the police actions that day? And why do we need penalties for this? Are we getting this?
So our organization, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, and the new national project, the Center for Protest Law and Litigation, and more on that project can be found at protestlaw.org. What we are doing is we have initiated a people's investigation into what happened on January 6th. Within hours of this violent attack on the Capitol, we were already preparing and then filed immediately records demands against agencies throughout the federal government and local government intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies, all of the different police forces that operate, all of the entities, including through the FBI and its Joint Terrorism Task Force. What we are seeking is the documents that we know exist and are created in advance of events, as well as the real-time running resumes and logs that will show what they knew, what they were reporting, what the decisions were, because we know that these agencies cannot be relied upon or trusted to investigate themselves. It is these agencies that had high command officials who made the decisions in advance of this to allow it to happen. And the reason that this is crucial, that we get this information out, we are preparing to litigate to get these records out for the public because we know what should exist and what does exist traditionally, that these agencies are filled and seated with supporters of white supremacists and of militias. It is an extraordinary danger to the people of the United States, and with local law enforcement, a huge danger to the communities that they are licensed to police to have these law enforcement entities who have guns and the ability to deprive people of their liberty, to have those personnel being affiliated and supporting white supremacist militias throughout the United States. This is an extraordinary danger right now. This threat is not past by far. It is clearly going to be resurging. And also, these agencies are cynically using their failures, or more accurately, their intentional omissions, to now claim that they need more resources and more authority to suppress actual First Amendment activity. The FBI immediately came out and claimed that they couldn't take action because their hands were tied by the First Amendment. 100% false statement, but it shows everything about what their intentions are, that they want to now use this right-wing attack on the Capitol to actually repress real First Amendment activity. And we know that that will be targeted against the racial justice movement, the environmental justice movement, the social justice movement. So we have to stop them by getting the facts out. And right now, there is discussion, even among Democrats in Congress and the Biden administration, of putting forward domestic terrorism laws based on what happened. They had all the laws at their disposal to stop this. They have all the laws at their disposal to prosecute what happened. They do not need more repressive legislation that, again, is going to be used against the progressive movement. We have to stop that from happening.
Mara, I watch many police procedurals on television, and last night I was watching FBI Most Wanted, where they were dealing with several individuals who were white supremacists and had killed several persons of color. But in the show, the FBI agents are made to look like heroes, when in reality, we've known for a while that there's a vein of white supremacy actually running through the ranks of law enforcement, both locally and federally. You've touched on this in what you've said thus far, but how bad a problem is that? And what can we do to cure it?
Well, think about the Greensboro massacre. I mean, the Greensboro massacre, if people don't know, they should read up on what happened. But when the white supremacists in the Greensboro massacre killed the racial justice activists and others, including socialists and communists, it turned out that they were partnering with the FBI, that there were federal agents who were involved in those actions. So this has always been an issue. I mean, go back to the civil rights movement and the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover's efforts to destroy the Black Liberation Movement, to destroy Martin Luther King. I mean, the FBI has never been the champion of racial and social justice in the United States. Now, they may be very good at also seeding people throughout Hollywood and having scripts written that create a propaganda, message for the people of the United States through these popular shows. But this is, a false presentation. And when it comes to police departments, there, around the United States right now, there are some efforts underway where police officers who actually participated in the attack on the Capitol are being exposed and dealt with. But there is by no means any comprehensive effort. There is no effort that can be relied upon that's being undertaken with the scope that should be necessary when you actually have people that are that dangerous, that are engaged in seditious conspiracy, who are still being allowed to operate with state-issued guns and badges and handcuffs. And this is a real danger that is posed throughout the U.S. right now.
What about the congressional office holders who aided and abetted the rioters? Can you talk about that, please, Mara?
I think from the congressional office holders to the former president of the United States, it is extraordinary to see sort of the kid gloves approach. Honestly, this focus on impeachment, which is going to do little more than actually strengthen the right wing, because right now the Democrats are just focused on impeachment once again, which is ultimately not going to have a meaningful impact on Donald Trump or on the right-wing seditionist movement that is around him and that I think we can anticipate is going to come back. This is simply actually giving time for the right wing, and right wing is really a gentle term. I mean, we're talking about a white supremacist, dangerous fascist movement to get stronger and to return rather than being dealt with decisively. That's what's happening here right now. The danger is extraordinary. We're not seeing the arrests that one would expect to see for what actually happened. I mean, a violent, fascist, white supremacist mob took up arms, attacked the Capitol of the United States with threats and what appeared to be attempt intentions to kill or injure congressional elected officials. I mean, you would think that the entire weight of the criminal code would come down on those actors. And yet we're seeing just, you know, handfuls of arrests, and we're seeing nothing that gets at the heart of what happened here. The criminal code has all manner of opportunity that law enforcement generally does not hesitate to use, and I would point out use, you know, it with false arrests and false charges against progressive political activists regularly. Here you have the actual definition of federal riot, and we don't support the federal riot law, but the fact is that it exists. They've used it against hundreds of racial justice protesters. This meets the definition of federal riot. This meets the definition of seditious conspiracy. Why Donald Trump has not been arrested on these charges, and others in Congress who are alleged to have led these people through for pre-intelligence gathering, so they knew the tunnels and where they could access other congressional offices, is extraordinary. They are allowing this to grow stronger and to become more dangerous rather than stopping what we could see was starting on January 6th.
Mara, we just have a few minutes left. I've been thinking a lot about how this moment will go down in history. If those in leadership, including law enforcement, are not held accountable, what message does that send not only to Americans, but also to other nations who watch the events as they were unfolding on January 6th on TV?
Well, the accountability in many respects, you know, when we talk about government accountability, it often is about the issue of sending a message, of wanting to show that we are defending democracy, that, you know, when highest-ranking officials commit illegal acts, that they will be held responsible. I think in this instance, we have moved into a whole different level of concern, going beyond accountability for past acts to a question of what is going to happen next. Because at this point, you have a violent, fascist, white supremacist movement that has taken root throughout the United States and that really feels that it is getting a pass from attacking the Capitol of the United States. And while there was some immediate disarray after that attack, the law enforcement that is, you know, compromised in this regard, coupled with elected officials who are completely weak and unable to make clear political decisions, are allowing that movement to get stronger and to grow. And I think we have to really worry about what we're going to see happen next unless decisive action is taken.
How can listeners learn more about your work, Mara? Do you have a website? Can you give that to us, please?
Yes, and we urge people to come join with us because we think we have to get this information out to the public. We believe getting the facts out is going to be crucial to stopping what we see is coming. And we can't rely on the government officials to do it themselves. So please come to protestlaw.org or justiceonline.org, or you can follow us on Twitter, and we'll be releasing material as we get it. And it's at protestlaw for Twitter or at the PCJF for Twitter. And we also have Facebook, Instagram. So please come find a way to connect with us. We need everyone joining together in the struggle.
Mara, it's always a delight to have you on Law and Disorder. We'll follow your work closely and hope to touch base with you again.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Fred Hampton was the young, dynamic leader of the Chicago chapter of the Black Panther Party. On December 4th of 1969, he was assassinated. An assassination is a political murder. He was assassinated as part of FBI leader J. Edgar Hoover's COINTEL program. COINTELPRO was initiated by Hoover to disrupt, destroy, and neutralize the party and the civil rights movement. Malcolm X and Martin Luther King had already been killed under suspicious circumstances. Our guest today is Chicago attorney Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office, who along with Jeff Haas, Dennis Cunningham, and Morton Stavis of the Center for Constitutional Rights was part of a team that after 13 years of litigation were able to prove that the FBI, the Chicago police, and the Chicago State's attorney were guilty of killing Fred Hampton, his fellow Black Panther Mark Clark, and wounding several others. The murders took place in a pre-dawn raid on Hampton's apartment. An FBI informer, William O'Neill, supplied the killers with a map of the apartment showing where Fred was sleeping and drugged, probably by O'Neill, when the police opened fire with a hail of 90 bullets. A Chicago police officer fired 2 shots into Hampton's head at close range as he lay in bed. It has recently been disclosed that O'Neill's control agent, Roy Mitchell, was paid a bonus for his and O'Neill's role in the assassination, and that Hoover and his top lieutenants, William Sullivan and George Moore, were aware of O'Neill's activities and authorized this award directly after the raid. What are the lessons we can learn from this? Is the FBI still doing COINTELPRO operations? How do we protect ourselves? We speak with returning guest attorney Flint Taylor. Flint and Jeff Haas have recently written an article about the new information, which can be found on Truthout and in the Black Agenda Report.
Flint Taylor, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. It's good to be with you and Mike as usual.
Flint, please talk a bit about Fred Hampton. Did you actually know him?
I did know Fred Hampton. I was a young law student at Northwestern. We had just started the People's Law Office August of that year. I had worked with law students and lawyers at the People's Law Office to get Fred out on appeal bond. He had been railroaded into a robbery charge and sent to the penitentiary for allegedly stealing $71 of ice cream and passing it out to the kids in Maywood, Illinois. And so he got back out on an appeal bond, came to a church and had a revival meeting that I was at with Jeff Haas and many others. And then later on in the fall, I brought him to Northwestern Law School, which at that time was a bastion of white, rich male law students to speak. And I got to meet him and hear him speak firsthand. I introduced him. It was my first foray into public speaking, and I stumbled a bit because the entire student body had come out to hear him. And he chided me a little bit about how I better get my act together and learn how to speak, which I've never forgotten. He was so dynamic, and he was not only he could hold a crowd, whether it was in a church with predominantly African-American folks from the community, as it was in August when he got out, or at Northwestern with the student body there. He just was that kind of speaker, but more than just a speaker, he was someone who led by example. The Panthers, of course, had a breakfast program. Fred would come down at 6 a.m. and be involved in serving breakfast for children. If he talked about self-defense against the police, he'd be the first in line with regard to that. Same with all the other programs, selling the newspaper, the weekly Black Panther newspaper. So he was a remarkable leader. He was a young messiah, as the FBI termed in terms of the COINTELPRO program that they wanted to stop and disrupt and ultimately destroy, messiahs such as Dr. King, Malcolm X, Elijah Muhammad, H. Rapp Brown, Stokely Carmichael. Fred fit right into that category. So, yes, I knew him. I admired him. He was younger than me at that time, but his experiences and what he was about as a revolutionary leader were just remarkable.
Now, Flint, he was killed on December 4th, 1969. What did the Chicago police say about what happened?
Well, the police, of course, and the state's attorney of Cook County, the rising star Ed Hanrahan, who was in line to take the place of Daley the First, who was the mayor at that time, they came back very confident after firing over 90 shots into the apartment and killing Hampton and Clark and maiming several other of the Panther survivors. They came back, lined up the guns that they'd taken from the apartment, and held a press conference that was covered by all four newspapers and the TV stations, and it was front-page news for weeks, actually, saying it was a vicious shootout. The Panthers fired 100 shots, but for the grace of God, the police would have been killed, when, in fact, of course, the shootout was narrative was a bold-faced lie. And over the next 13 years, we at the People's Law Office and the community, the Panthers, the families of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark fought to change that narrative. And over the years, we were able to change that narrative from a shootout to a shoot-in, 90 bullets to perhaps one fired by the Panthers, to a murder, the fact that Fred was sleeping in his bed and shot through the head, to an assassination, a political assassination, shown by the FBI involvement that was kept secret for several years, and the fact that the FBI's COINTELPRO program was, in fact, behind the assassination of Fred Hampton.
Flint, talk a bit about COINTELPRO. Did it aim to destroy the Black Panther Party?
Well, the COINTELPRO actually started out with an idea in the mind of J. Edgar Hoover and a reality, really, before he was even made the head of the fledgling FBI in 1924. He was at the Justice Department and headed up the Palmer raids, which, of course, were the raids against anarchists and other left and working class people in 1919 in the wake of World War One. And when he came to the FBI, they devised this COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program, which was initially focused on people like Marcus Garvey and also the Communist Party, and later the Socialist Workers Party. So in the 50s, 40s and 50s, It was a disruption program that was mostly into slandering leaders of those parties, getting them fired from their jobs, that kind of disruption. But when the Black Liberation Movement came along in the 60s and the Civil Rights Movement, Hoover and his lieutenants, William Sullivan and George Moore at the FBI, focused and refocused COINTELPRO on that movement, and it became more and more violent and more disruptive. In 1967 and 1968, Hugh Hoover instructed all 41 offices in the country under COINTELPRO to focus on Black leadership, on King and Elijah Muhammad, and pointed to Malcolm X as an example. He at that time had been assassinated, and Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown, and said that they needed to neutralize and disrupt these them and their organizations to prevent the unity between and coalitions between Black, white, and other people of color, and to prevent the rise of messiahs such as those men that I named who were leading those organizations. And then, as the Panthers became strong, right in the wake of those documents, they focused on the Panthers, and then it became even more violent. And, of course, it culminated in many respects in 1969 in the COINTELPRO's program in Chicago, which led and set up the assassination of Fred Hampton.
Why was the Panther Party a threat to them, a threat to the status quo? What was the political program of the Black Panther Party?
Well, the Panthers, it was a multifaceted threat. Hoover exaggerated it in some regard because of the racism and white supremacy that he was such an example of. But they had a very vibrant 10-point program, and it covered many things that are still important today, everything from a free breakfast program to free medical clinic. But it also was very revolutionary in its politics. It was revolutionary in the sense that it called for arming against police brutality, defending against police brutality, resisting the war in Vietnam, not resisting the draft, talked about anti-imperialism, talked about the kinds of things that revolutionaries were talking about during that period of time. And so the Panthers were very much on the ground with the programs that were socialistic in design, and also their newspaper. They had a weekly newspaper, and it was very self-conscious in terms of putting out the Panther line, putting out the Panther politics. The back of every Panther paper had this 10-point program that laid out all of their principles and their programs. Not only did they talk the talk and walk the walk in terms of defending themselves and defending their offices and their homes when the police would raid them, but they attacked the power structure in the sense of they called out the leaders, they called out Hoover, they called out State's Attorney Hanrahan. They talked about repression, and they talked about oppression, and they talked about racism, but they talked about, as Fred would say, we don't fight fire with fire, meaning certain Black nationalist approaches, but we fight fire with water. And so they were very much a threat ideologically. They were a threat on the ground as well, and that gave Hoover the pretext to, in fact, destroy them, and that's what ultimately the Senator Church Committee on Intelligence in the wake of Watergate, which was doing a parallel investigation at the time, same time we were litigating and investigating the role of the FBI here in Chicago with regard to the assassination of Fred Hampton. The Church Committee found in 1976 that the raid, of course, was part of COINTELPRO, and that the aim of Hoover's COINTELPRO program in the late 60s was to, quote, destroy, unquote, the Black Panther Party.
Flint, let's go back again to December 4th, 1969. Earlier, you mentioned the issue about bullets going in or out, but can you paint a brief chronology for our listeners of what happened that night?
Yes. We later learned that the FBI and Roy Martin Mitchell, one of the major actors in the Racial Matters Squad here in Chicago, had this informant provocateur named William O'Neill, and that O'Neill had designed a floor plan of the apartment where Fred and the others, Mark Clark and the survivors, were all staying, and they supplied that floor plan and information about guns being there to the state's attorney of Cook County, and this was part of the COINTELPRO program and was claimed as such later in secret documents. The state's attorney of Cook County, Ed Hanrahan, had 14 Chicago police officers assigned to him as his own little private Gestapo force. And so he took the floor plan and planned the raid for 4:30 in the morning when the Panthers would be sleeping. And 14 heavily armed police officers under the command of Hanrahan went to the apartment and broke in front and back, fired over 90 bullets from machine guns, shotguns, handguns, into the small apartment, stitching the walls between where the Panthers were sleeping, entered the back bedroom where Fred was sleeping, drugged, and shot him through the head twice. And the 90 bullets that they fired from the machine guns and other guns seriously wounded four other Panthers and left Mark Clark, who was sitting at the front door, a sitting sentry, murdered. So that all happened, and as we talked about earlier, they came back. The police left the place open, triumphant, to claim that they had been involved in the shootout and tamed the vicious Black Panthers, while we, and myself included, went to the apartment. They left it open, and I spent the next 10 days in that apartment helping to take evidence, taking pictures, video of what really happened in the apartment, while Jeff and others, Dennis Cunningham, talked to the Panther survivors who had been taken to jail and charged with attempted murder. And suffice it to say that those events shaped the People's Law Office for and all of us for decades and decades to come.
You only had a limited knowledge at the time of the trial about the FBI's role in the raid. What did you know then? And then we're going to ask you, what did you find out recently?
Right. Well, because O'Neill was exposed as an informant in another case, we then knew that our client, who we thought was a Black Panther member in good standing, one of the security men for the Panthers, was in fact an FBI informant. Once we learned that, we had a lawsuit, a 1983 civil rights lawsuit, pending in federal court. And so we shifted gears and focused on discovering the FBI and what their real role was. And early on, we were able to get this floor plan that I mentioned. So we knew that the FBI informant had been integral to planning the raid. And we also knew, because of the media Pennsylvania break-in of the FBI offices and also by Freedom of Information Act documents, that this broad plan that Hoover had to neutralize and disrupt. But we didn't have the link between COINTELPRO and the raid. We had the FBI, but we didn't have it as part of the COINTELPRO program, which of course would make it a much broader nationwide conspiracy. So we fought for those COINTELPRO documents. The judge, who was extremely reactionary and racist, wouldn't give us those documents, but we were able to get them through the church committee. We got some, including a document that showed that the raid was claimed on December 3rd, the day before it happened, as a COINTELPRO project. So we then had two real building blocks in our conspiracy. And then during the trial, the government was exposed and the FBI was exposed to having hidden 200 volumes of documents. And so in those documents was the third building block, which was what we called the bonus document. O'Neill was given $300 bonus which translates to about $2,000 today. His 30 pieces of silver of setting up Fred Hampton and making the raid of tremendous value, his information, and making the raid a success, and that, and who, and the people in Washington, the FBI, gave O'Neill this bonus right after the raid. So then we had a very strong case of an FBI conspiracy with the locals, but we didn't have that link with Washington, with Hoover, with Sullivan, and with George Moore, the powers that be in Washington that were the masterminds of the nationwide plan to disrupt, neutralize, and destroy. And so we fought for that evidence, and we fought to put those men in our case, but we were never allowed to do so. And so when we settled the case in 1983, after 13 years of litigation, we had a strong belief that the people in Washington were involved in not only COINTELPRO in general, but specifically with regard to the murder of Fred Hampton. And that's where we come to the documents that Aaron Leonard, the historian, got through Freedom of Information Act just this past December.
And what do those documents reveal?
Well, these were from the personnel file of Roy Mitchell. And I mentioned him before because he was such a central figure here in Chicago. He controlled O'Neill, the informant provocateur, and he was the one who, in fact, was engineering the raid as part of COINTELPRO. And we didn't have those documents. When they turned those 200 volumes of documents that they covered up in our trial, these files were not among them. And these documents showed that not only was O'Neill given a bonus, but that Hoover personally, as well as Sullivan, the head of domestic intelligence and the mastermind in the program against Dr. King, and Moore, who was the head of the extremist section that was focused on the Panthers, they all were aware of O'Neill and his activities just before the raid. They were touting Mitchell and O'Neill's activities right before the raid. And right after the raid, they approved a ward of sorts for Mitchell, a bonus for him, that they had the head of the FBI here in Chicago, who was a defendant in our case, personally give to Mitchell right after the raid. So that would have given us the documentary proof that we were arguing and believed that down in Washington, Hoover was on top of the O'Neill situation and the Hampton situation, and so were the highest levels of the Domestic Intelligence Division, Sullivan and Moore. And so these are the documents that we get some 51 years later, including another document that buttressed our argument of how the FBI was successful in covering up their involvement for 3 or 4 years when there were several investigations here, including a federal investigation and a special state investigation, and how Mitchell was instructed to not talk about the role of the FBI in setting up the raid. That was another document, highly excised, that Leonard got and passed on to Jeff Haas and me as the lawyers for the Hampton family over all these years, including the 18-month trial that Jeff and I litigated. So there's still some questions because these documents are highly excised. And also, what's left here? We need a total open file policy now. Biden and the people in Washington at the Justice Department need to open up all the files, and we need to see really all of the involvement of all of the high-level officials. You know, very interestingly, on the morning of the raid, while we were inside, the Panthers were leading tours of the apartment, which they led for the entire 10 or 15 days before the police finally closed the apartment. And Bobby Rush, who, along with Fred, were the co-leaders of the Panthers here in Chicago, he stood in front of the door of the Panther apartment and to the whole world said, "We lay this raid, these murders, at the foot of J. Hu Edgar." So the Panthers understood politically that J. Edgar Hoover and Washington and the FBI were behind it. But we spent the next 13 years proving that the FBI was behind it. And now we're getting even more information that shows that, yes, J. Hu Edgar was involved as well.
Fred Hampton was on a secret FBI list. Do you think that the FBI still keeps lists like this? Talk about their list they call the Black Identity Extremists.
Yeah, they had three or four lists, the agitator, and they called them indexes back then, I think, because they kept index cards, old-fashioned index cards. They had a rabble-rouser index, an agitator index, and a couple others, and I'm sure Fred was on all of them. And yeah, the black extremist list, and there's another list that I just heard about recently. I can't remember exactly what it was called, that's in vogue now. Well, of course, we have the Do Not Fly list, right? We have the modern-day versions of those lists that the FBI kept during the day. And not only did they target the leaders and the organizations that the FBI is most deftly worried about and the government sees as threats to its power, but they also completely over-exclusive as well. And, you know, they'll have the little old grandma who drove somebody to a meeting at a church may end up on the list or in a file. So you have over-inclusive surveillance, and then you have the disruption and the neutralization and ultimately attempt to destroy movement organizations that are at the focal point of significant and revolutionary and radical change in this country.
Flynn, we're running out of time. Briefly, would you call the FBI an American political police force?
Definitely. I mean, that's very very apropos. I mean, if you trace its entire history, that's what it has been. I think that's what it continues to be in a very large sense. I mean, the propaganda way back in the day, before most of your listeners were around, was Efren Zimbalist Jr. and the FBI. And now they're touting a new FBI show. I can't say that I've watched it or intend to watch it. But, you know, the image that they're giving is crime fighters, right? But they're not only crime fighters, if they are, and they're kind of ineffectual when it comes to that, by and large. But they got a big surveillance arm, and they got a disruption arm, and that hasn't changed. I mean, it's mutated to some degree in what they do and how they do it. But I think they still have an arm that's the political police. And that we have to be very wary of it, particularly given the events at the Capitol, where we see on the one hand they weren't, and I use the term broader law enforcement, including the FBI, wasn't of a mind to stop what happened there, but they seem to be of a mind to use it to further criminalize activities that will probably redound against the left more powerfully than they will against white supremacy, because, of course, we see that the FBI and powerful aspects of the government are behind and a part and parcel of white supremacy in this country and always have been.
Flynn Taylor, before we let you go, tell our listeners how they can follow your work and the work of the People's Law Office.
Well, you can. I wrote a book called The Torture Machine, Racism and Police Violence in Chicago, and I discuss the Hampton case, and then I talk about the systemic police torture here in Chicago that went on for over 20 years. Jeff Haas, my partner, a longtime partner in terms of the Hampton case, has also written a book on the assassination of Fred Hampton, which can be obtained. And Heidi and Mike, there's a movie coming out. We'll be very interested to see how Ryan Coogler deals with the relationship between Fred Hampton and William O'Neill. The movie's coming out the 12th of February. It's called Judas and the Black Messiah, O'Neill and Fred Hampton. It has some very, very good actors playing those roles. Mitchell, of course, is in it as well. But we know Hollywood. So we'll have to see how they popularize the assassination of Fred Hampton, and we're looking forward to seeing it and perhaps critiquing it.
Well, we're looking forward to having you back on Law and Disorder to talk about the movie.
Yes, we'll have to play the Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel role. If people in Chicago probably know what I'm talking about.
Right.
Well, it's great talking to you both.
Flint, always a pleasure.
Yes. You both take care, and I know we'll be talking again as all of this unfolds with regard to how the next chapter of white supremacy and government repression and the resistance and Black Lives Matter and all of the things that are going on today that are so significant. And the history that we just talked about is so significant to the current events and the current struggles and the current movements.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.